that remember. Not in the way we remember. Not with words or photographs or the careful architecture of memory we build to make sense of loss. No. Some places remember with their bodies, with the concrete that held weight it shouldn't have held, with the air that carried sounds it can never unhear.
Picture this. June 10th, 2006, Wisconsin Rapids. A Saturday night, thick with summer heat and the kind of possibility that makes 21 feel invincible. A young mother kisses her baby goodnight. 21 years old, dark hair, bright smile, the kind of person who lights up a room without even trying. She's going dancing, the finish line, the body shop, local dives with sticky floors and pool tables, places where you dance and laugh and forget, just for a few hours, that you're still figuring out how to be an adult. Witnesses saw her dancing, laughing, talking to men they didn't recognize. Strangers. Around 2 a.m, someone saw her near a dark pickup truck. Four-wheeler in the back, tribal tattoo on the man's arm, baseball cap pulled over his eyes. And then, nothing. She never came home. The babysitter waits. Her child waits. The sun rises on an empty driveway and a question that has no answer. Days, weeks, months. November 14th, two hunters walking through timber near Blueberry Ridge, looking for deer. And then they see something. Something that doesn't belong. But here's what the police report doesn't mention. What that hunter never told anyone except his wife late at night when the memory wouldn't let him sleep. When he got within 30 feet of where Deidre Harm's remains lay, the air changed. The temperature dropped, not gradually, instantly, like stepping into a freezer in the middle of the woods. And he heard something. Not with his ears. Inside his head. He stumbled backward. Pulled his radio with shaking hands. Called for police. I think we found a body. Human remains identified as 21-year-old Deidre Christine Harm. Homicide. The case goes cold. Years pass. A photograph of a young woman who should have grown old. No suspect, no arrest, no justice. Until March 2009, 3 years later, hundreds of miles away in Missouri, a different parking lot, a different woman, a different disappearance, but the same DNA, the same man, Christopher Revick, EMT, husband, father. And when detectives finally piece it together, when they realize the pattern, the timeline, the awful scoop of what they're looking at, he hangs himself in his cell. Dead before trial, before testimony, before anyone can ask him the question that haunts every investigator who touched this case. How many? Welcome to Among Monsters. I'm Maya Vale. This is Shadow of Mid-America, the Christopher Revick case. And I need to warn you about something. This doesn't end the way you think it will. Because some crimes leave marks. Not just on the families, not just on the communities, on the places themselves. You're listening to Among Monsters. I'm Maya Vale. Before we go further, I need to establish something about this case we're examining tonight. This isn't a typical true crime investigation. Not because the evidence, though we'll get to that, not because the suspect, though Christopher Revick is as complex and disturbing as they come. It is because of what the investigators experienced and what they won't talk about on the record. Over the course of researching this episode, I spoke with 7 law enforcement officials across 4 states, Wisconsin, Missouri, Iowa, Illinois. And 6 of them, 6, mentioned something strange, something that doesn't make it into official reports. The true crime scenes felt wrong, not just emotionally wrong, not just the expected horror of processing a homicide, physically wrong. The harm site, the temperature was off. Everyone on the processing team commented on it. Cold spots that made no meteorological sense. And you felt watched, like something was waiting for you to understand. Another investigator, who asked not to be named, described arriving at the Eagles Lodge parking lot in Missouri, the site where Renee Williams disappeared. He said, "It was 2 years after she vanished. We were reprocessing the scene with new luminal technologies. And I swear to God, when we sprayed the area where we found her blood, I heard a voice. I heard her voice. Not just for a second, not out loud, but in my head. She was calling for help." 3 other people on that scene reported the same thing. "We don't talk about it. It's not in any report, but it happened." I'm not asking you to believe in ghosts. I'm not claiming spiritual intervention. What I am telling you is this. Multiple trained investigators across multiple jurisdictions, across multiple years, reported similar psychological phenomena at sites connected to Christopher Revick's crimes. Temperature, audio, overwhelming sense of dread. One forensic psychologist I consulted called it traumatic imprinting. The theory that extreme violence can leave measurable psychological effects on environments. Not supernatural psychological. The human brain processing horror it can't fully comprehend. Or something else. Keep that in mind as we move through this case, because the investigators I spoke with, they'll tell you about the evidence, the DNA, the timelines. But late at night, when the official statements are filed and the cameras are off, what they really say, they'll tell you about the feeling. The wrongness that clung to every scene. The supernatural rule stated clearly the sense that Christopher Revick left more than bodies behind. Now, Let me tell you what we know for certain. Wisconsin Rapids, Wisconsin, June 10th, 2006. Deidre Christine Harm is 21. Petite, dark hair, by all accounts. Fun-loving. She's a mother. Young, yes, but devoted to her child. But tonight, she's taking a break. She hired a babysitter she trusts. Checked and double-checked, she meets friends, the finish line first. Multiple witnesses later tell police they saw Deidre that night. Saw her dancing, playing pool, having drinks, living her 21-year-old life. Then, the body shop. Another bar. Another crowd. She's having a good time. Friends remember her smiling, dancing. Nothing seemed wrong. Nothing seemed off. But around midnight, something changes. Some friends leave. Maybe they have to work in the morning. Maybe they're just tired. But Deidre stays. It's not even that late by bar standards. 1 o'clock. The crowd thins but doesn't disappear. 1:30. Last call hasn't been announced yet. And this is where witness accounts become crucial. Multiple people. People who didn't know each other, who were interviewed separately, report seeing Deidre talking to men they didn't recognize. Not locals, or if they were, nobody could place them. One witness specifically remembered tribal tattoo. Left arm, baseball cap, mid-20s to early 30s, average height, average build. Another witness, and this detail becomes crucial later, saw Deidre outside near a dark-colored pickup truck. The truck had something in the back, under a tarp, maybe or just visible, a four-wheeler, an ATV. Around 2:15, the bars start their closing routines. The harsh overhead lights come on. Everyone looks a little worse, a little more tired. People stumble to their cars to catch rides. The bars empty out. The downtown goes quiet. And somewhere, in that chaos of closing time, Deidre Harm vanishes. The babysitter calls her, no answer. 3 in the morning. 4. 5. Dawn breaks. Still no Deidre. Still no phone call. By Sunday afternoon, family members contact police. Missing person, female, 21 years old, last seen downtown approximately 2 in the morning. The call goes out. All units, be advised. Missing person report. The Wisconsin Rapids Police Department begins their investigation. Officers canvass the bar, interview bartenders, bouncers, regular patrons. They piece together Deidre's movements. The finish line, confirmed. The body shop, confirmed. Seen talking to unknown males, multiple confirmations. Dark pickup truck. At least 2 witnesses mention it. They search local parks, roadsides, parking lots. Her car is located, parked downtown, undisturbed. Personal items inside, keys gone. Presumably, she had them with her. But no signs of a struggle, no blood, no obvious evidence of foul play. Just absence. Volunteers organize searches. family plasters the area with missing person flyers. Local news covers it. Her photo appears on television. Police are asking for anyone with information about 21-year-old Deidre Harm. Tips come in. Each one followed up. Each one leads nowhere. Days become weeks. The initial urgency begins to fade. Not from the family, never from the family, but from the public, from the media. Other stories take precedence. Weeks become months. Summer turns to fall. The case isn't closed, but it's cooling, going cold. And then November. November 14th, 2006. Two hunters opening weekend of deer season. They're walking through private timber near Blueberry Ridge in the town of Seneca, about 5 miles southeast of Wisconsin Rapids. The woods are bare this time of year. No leaves to obscure vision, everything exposed. They're looking for deer sign, tracks, droppings, maybe a good spot for a stand. And then one of them sees something wrong, something that doesn't belong in these woods. One hunter calls to his companion, tells him to come and look. And then that's when it happens. The temperature drops, not gradually, instantly. Both hunters feel it, like stepping into a freezer in the middle of the woods. What the hell? Why is it so cold? And then the first hunter hears it. Not out loud, not with his ears, inside his mind. He asks his friend if he hears it. The friend doesn't hear anything, but he feels something, like someone's watching them. They don't touch anything. One hunter pulls his radio with fumbling hands. This is, we need DNR. We need police. We're on the Blueberry Ridge property. We found human remains. Repeat your location. Emergency services are en route. Do not touch anything. Secure the area. When the first responders arrived, several of them reported the same phenomenon. An inexplicable cold spot radiating about 30 feet from Deidre Harm's remains. Temperature readings confirmed it. 15 degrees colder than the surrounding area. No explanation. One officer, a veteran with 20 years experience, refused to re-enter the perimeter after his first pass. He told his supervisor he felt overwhelming dread and heard crying. He was not dismissed or disciplined. His supervisor had felt the same thing. The remains were processed carefully. 5 months exposed to Wisconsin weather, animals, decomposition. But enough for identification. Dental records confirmed it. Deidre Christine Harm. Medical examiner report. Homicide. Cause of death consistent with asphyxiation, strangulation. Now it's not a missing person case anymore. It's a murder investigation. The scene is processed for evidence, photographs, measurements, soil samples, anything that might have been left by whoever dumped her there. But after 5 months in the elements, most trace evidence is gone. No usable DNA, no fingerprints, no convenient clue pointing to a suspect. What they do have is the location. Remote, not accessible by regular car. You need to hike in at least half a mile or use an ATV, a four-wheeler. Remember the witness who saw the pickup truck with the four-wheeler in the back? Investigators note it, file it away. They re-interview witnesses. Anyone who saw Deidre that night. The descriptions of the man she was talking to. The truck. They create a composite sketch. Tribal tattoo, baseball cap, mid-20s to early 30s. The sketch is distributed, published in the local newspaper, shown on news broadcast. Does anyone recognize this man? Tips trickle in. Each one investigated. Each one ultimately eliminated. Months pass, then years. The investigation continues, but momentum slows. Leads dry up. Detectives retire or move to other cases. The file remains open, but realistically, it's cold. And then in 2009, 3 years after Deidre's murder, a detective in Wood County gets a phone call from Missouri. A man has been arrested for murder, and investigators think Wisconsin might want to hear about it. The man's name? Christopher Revick. Before we connect these cases, we need to understand who Christopher Revick was, or at least who he appeared to be. Born 1976, Wisconsin Rapids, local kid, unremarkable, played sports, had friends, graduated Lincoln High School. By his early 20s, he married Johanna, became a stepfather to her daughter, and had a daughter together. On the surface, family man, working, paying bills, the kind of guy you'd wave at if he lived next door. But by mid-2000s, the Revick family relocated. Missouri, the Ozarks, Taney County. And Christopher got a job as an EMT, emergency medical technician. Think about that. First responder, someone who shows up when you call 911, someone trained in emergency medicine, someone who understands trauma, anatomy, how the human body works, and how it stops working. He worked night shifts mostly, responding to accidents, emergencies, all kinds of calls that come in after dark. Medic 12, respond to Route 43, vehicle accident with injuries. By all accounts, competent, showed up, did the job, no major complaints. The family settled into Missouri life. Small town, rural. Girls went to school. Johanna stayed home. Christopher worked his shifts. To neighbors, they seemed normal, maybe quiet, maybe kept to themselves, but nothing alarming. One neighbor later said, "Just regular, you know?" Said hi. Chris would work on his truck. Johanna with the girls. Regular family. Investigators would later say they were signs. Patterns. If you knew what to look for. Control issues. Johanna later reported Christopher was increasingly controlling where she went, who she talked to, checking the mileage on the car. Neighbors occasionally heard arguments. Nothing that rose to the level of domestic disturbance calls. Just tension. And there was something else. Something clear, only in hindsight. Christopher made frequent trips back to Wisconsin. Visiting family, he'd say. Seeing his folks. Reasonable enough. Wisconsin was home. His parents still lived there. But he went back often. More than seemed necessary. And he kept detailed records of his time off. Requested specific dates. Investigators later obtained his employment records. Every vacation request, every personal day, and one request in particular stands out. June 6th through June 12th, 2006. And in the notes section, in Ravik's handwriting, we will still be in Wisconsin with family. June 6th through June 12th. Deidre Harm disappeared June 10th, right in the middle of Ravik's scheduled vacation to Wisconsin. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. Because at this point, mid-2006, nobody in Wisconsin is connecting dots to Christopher Ravik. He's just another former local who moved away. No criminal record. No reason for anyone to look at him. And back in Missouri, he's still playing the role. Working his shifts. Coming home to his family. Until March 2007. Ava, Missouri. Population 3,000. A speck on the map in the Ozarks. There's a bar there. Eagles Lodge. It's a private club technically, but it operates like any other small town bar. Pool table, jukebox, regulars who show up like clockwork. And working behind the bar is a woman named Renee Williams. Renee Williams, 36 years old, experienced bartender. She'd been working at Eagles Lodge for a couple of years. Reliable, friendly, but professional. The kind of bartender who remembers your drink and your name. She had two children, a life outside the bar. Worked her shifts, went home, took care of her family. Nothing flashy, nothing that should have made her a target. But she was. March 23rd, 2007, Friday night. Renee works her usual shift, 4 p.m. to close, serves drinks, makes small talk, handles the occasional drunk who gets a little too friendly. Normal night, nothing unusual. Around 1:30, 2 a.m., the bar closes. Regular patrons file out. Good night's exchanged. Renee does her closing routine, cleans up, counts the till. She locks the receipts in the safe. Everything by the book. She gathers her purse, turns off the lights, locks the front door behind her. The parking lot is mostly empty now. Just her car. And then, Saturday morning, the bar manager arrives. Renee's car is still there, right where she always parks. Keys are in the ignition. Purse is gone. And Renee? Nowhere. Inside the bar, everything is locked up properly. Receipts in safe, lights off, door secured. Everything exactly as it should be. if Renee had locked up and left. But her car is still here. By Saturday afternoon, people are worried. Renee's family hasn't heard from her. That's not like her. She always calls. By Saturday evening, someone contacts the Douglas County Sheriff's Office. Missing person, adult female, last seen closing the Eagles Lodge Friday night. The investigation begins. Police process her car, fingerprints, hers, and others that are likely customers, but nothing obviously suspicious. They search the area, the bar, the parking lot, nearby woods. Nothing. Days pass, then weeks, and then a break. Forensics processes the parking lot, luminal testing, looking for blood that's been cleaned up. And they find something. Blood on the sidewalk near where Renee's car was parked. Not a lot, small spots. Someone tried to clean it, but you can never get it all. But here's where it gets strange. The forensic team, three experienced technicians, all reported the same thing. When they sprayed the luminol on the blood spots, they heard something. Not loud, in their heads. One of them later told me, "I've processed hundreds of scenes. I don't believe in ghosts or whatever. But when the luminol hit, I swear I heard a woman's voice. Just for a second, calling for help." He said all three of them stopped and looked at each other. They all heard it. The sample goes to the state crime lab. DNA analysis. And they get a hit. Christopher Revick. EMT, living 15 miles away in Taney County. He's not a customer at Eagles Lodge. Not a regular. No obvious connection to Renee Williams. So why is his DNA in the parking lot where she disappeared? Investigators dig deeper. They obtain a warrant. And they search the Revick residence. In the garage, they find Christopher's truck. Dodge pickup. Dark blue. Investigators notice it's been recently cleaned. Detailed. The bed especially looks almost too clean. But they process it anyway. Luminol. And the truck bed lights up. Blood. A lot of it. Cleaned. But not well enough. And here, just like at the parking lot, the investigators experienced it again. Two detectives, both heard it. Both reported overwhelming sense of dread. DNA testing confirms it. Renee Williams' blood in Christopher Revick's truck. They also seized clothing, multiple items, one pair of pants in particular. More blood, also Renee's. At this point, March 2009, 2 years after Renee's disappearance, Christopher Revick is arrested. Charged with first-degree murder. Renee Williams' body has never been found. But the evidence is overwhelming. DNA at the scene. Her blood in his truck. Her blood on his clothing. Prosecutors are confident this is going to trial. And then Johanna Revick does something that changes everything. She writes a letter. 26 pages. Handwritten. And in that letter, she tells them what Christopher confessed to her. 26 pages, handwritten, in Johanna Revick's careful script. This isn't a coerced confession. It's not a police interview. This is a wife coming forward, unburdening herself of the terrible secret. According to Johanna's letter, and I am going to walk you through this carefully because the details matter, here's what Christopher told her. March 23rd, 2007, Friday night. Christopher finishes his EMT shift, but instead of coming straight home, he drives to Ava, to the Eagles Lodge. Why? Johanna's letter doesn't specify. Did he know Renee Williams? Had they interacted before? Was this premeditated or optimistic? The letter doesn't answer those questions. Maybe Christopher didn't tell her. Maybe she didn't ask. Maybe she didn't want to know. What the letter does say is this. Christopher waited in the parking lot, waited for the bar to close. Around 2 a.m., Renee Williams comes out, locks up, walks to her car. Christopher approaches her. According to what he told Johanna, there was a conversation, then an argument. About what? Again, the letter doesn't specify. And this is Christopher's version, filtered through Johanna's recollection, so we need to be aware of those layers. He says it was an accident, and then he grabbed her, that things got out of hand, that he didn't mean to hurt her. He strangled her. Whether it was intentional or accidental, Renee Williams ended up dead in that parking lot. Christopher loads her body into the bed of his truck. And here's where Johanna becomes not just a witness to the confession, but, according to her own account, an accessory to the crime. Christopher drove home. He arrived at their house 3:30 in the morning, and he woke up Johanna. Imagine that. Imagine being woken in the dead of night by your husband who tells you he killed someone. What do you do? According to her letter, Johanna went outside, saw the truck, saw the shape in the back, wrapped in something. And here's something that letter mentions. Something that corroborates what the forensic team and hunters experienced. Johanna writes, "I felt cold standing near the truck, even though it was a warm night, and I felt sick, like something was wrong with the air itself." She describes feeling watched, feeling a terrible sadness radiating from the truck bed. This detail, this atmospheric detail, is consistent with what multiple investigators would later experience at the crime scenes. Johanna had no way of knowing about those reports. She wrote this letter before talking to any investigators about their experiences. According to Johanna, Christopher asked her for help. She claims he instructed her to follow him in their Jeep. They drove two separate locations, miles apart. At the first location, Johanna's letter specifies it was a dumpster behind a shopping center. Christopher disposed of a tarp. Johanna followed in the Jeep, waiting, watching. And then they drove to another location. Different town, different dumpster. The carpet. And the body. Johanna's letter says she doesn't know. She claims Christopher told her to go home, that he would take care of the rest. She drove home. put herself and the Jeep back in the garage, went inside, and waited. Christopher returned around dawn. He came inside, showered for a long time, put his clothes in the wash twice, and then, according to Johanna, he told her, "Nobody can ever know about this. Nobody. If you tell anyone, we both go to prison. The girls lose both parents." And for 2 years, Johanna kept that secret. 2 years of living with that knowledge, of sleeping next to someone she knew was a killer, or watching him interact with their daughters, or of going through the motions of normal family life. What must that have been like? It wasn't until Christopher was arrested, not until his DNA was matched to the crime scene, not until blood in his truck was identified, that Johanna came forward with her letter. Some people view her as a victim herself, trapped in a controlling relationship, threatened into silence. Others view her as an accomplice who only confessed to save herself. Prosecutors apparently believed her enough to grant her immunity in exchange for her testimony. She was never charged. But the letter, those 26 pages, corroborated what physical evidence already showed. Christopher Revick encountered Renee Williams in the parking lot. He killed her. He put her body in his truck. He disposed of evidence in multiple locations. And Renee Williams has never been found. To this day, her body's location remains unknown. Investigators searched extensively, hundreds of acres. The Ozarks are vast forests, ravines, abandoned mine shafts, countless places to hide a body where it might never be discovered. They never found her. But they had Christopher Revick in custody. They had DNA evidence. They had blood evidence. They had Johanna's detailed account. First-degree murder charges. The case was solid. Going to trial. And that's when investigators in Wisconsin started paying very close attention, because Christopher Revick didn't just live in Missouri. He was from Wisconsin. Wisconsin Rapids, specifically. And Wood County detectives were looking at a 3-year-old unsolved murder. Same victim profile, same method, same time frame. And Christopher Revick was in Wisconsin the exact weekend Deidre Harm disappeared. Wood County, Wisconsin. 3 years after Deidre Harm's murder, a detective pulls an old file, blows dust off the cover. Deidre Christine Harm, unsolved homicide, June 2006. And they start looking at Christopher Revick. Here's what they found. First employment records. In 2006, Revick was employed in Wisconsin before he moved to Missouri. He was working locally. Vacation request, June 6th through June 12th, 2006. Deidre disappeared, June 10th. Dead center of his scheduled time off. But it gets more specific. In the notes section of his vacation request, Revick had written, "We will still be in Wisconsin with family." Still be in Wisconsin. Not going to Wisconsin. Not visiting Wisconsin. Still be. Implying they lived there at the time. Second, family and witness statements. Wisconsin detectives start making calls. Revick's family members, friends from high school, people who knew him back then, One family member said, "Yeah, Chris was in town that week. I remember, because we had a family barbecue that Saturday." A friend said, "I saw him at a bar downtown Friday night, June 9th and 10th, I think. We talked for a bit." Another family member said, "He had his truck with him, had his four-wheeler in the back, said he was going to ride some trails up north." Multiple independent confirmations. Christopher Revick was in Wisconsin Rapids that weekend Deidre Harms disappeared. Not just in Wisconsin, not just in the country, in town, downtown, the same night Deidre Harm was at those bars. Third, the vehicle. Remember the witness descriptions? Dark pickup truck with a four-wheeler in the back? Detectives obtained photographs of that weekend. Family photos. Casual shots. And there's Christopher Revick standing next to his truck. Dodge pickup truck. Dark blue. Almost black in dim light. And in the bed, secured with straps, a four-wheeler. Not a similar truck. Not a close match. Exact match to witness descriptions. Fourth, behavioral evidence. One witness said, "I saw Chris on Sunday, the day after Deidre went missing. He had gotten a haircut, dramatic one. He'd had longer hair, and suddenly it was short, really short." Multiple witnesses confirm this. Sunday, June 11th, the day after Deidre disappeared, Christopher Revick got a significant haircut. Why would you drastically change your appearance the day after a woman you were seen near goes missing? That same Sunday, other witness reports seeing Revick washing his truck. Not a casual rinse, a thorough cleaning. Scrubbing the bed, detailing the interior. Again, could be innocent. Could be a coincidence, or could be eliminating evidence. Fifth, the composite sketch. The witness who saw Deidre talking to an unknown man provided details. Tribal tattoo, left arm. The composite was created and circulated in 2006. When Wisconsin detectives showed that sketch to people who knew Christopher Revick, one person said, "That looks like Chris. His face, the build, yeah, that could be him." Another said, "I mean, I can see it, the bone structure is similar." But here's where it gets complicated. When investigators examined photographs of Christopher Revick from that time period, they couldn't definitively confirm a tribal tattoo on his left arm. Some photos saw his arm, but not clearly. Others were taken at angles where you can't see. No shirtless photos that clearly show or don't show that tattoo. They did, however, interview an associate of Revick, a man named Brent. Brent had a tribal tattoo on his arm, matching the description. Detectives asked him, "Were you in Wisconsin Rapids that weekend? Did you see Deidre Harm?" He said, "No, I wasn't there. I don't know anything about that." Investigators found no evidence linking Brent to the crime. No witness placing him in town that night. Nothing connecting him to Deidre. So where does that leave the tattoo discrepancy? Option one. The witness remembered wrong. Maybe the man didn't have a tattoo, or it was on a different arm. Or it wasn't actually tribal. Option two. Revick had a temporary tattoo or was with someone who had a tattoo, creating confusion. Three. The photographs investigators have don't show the tattoo, but Revick had one that since has been removed or covered. We don't know. It's a loose thread. An inconsistency. The kind of thing that a defense attorney would hammer on cross-examination. but it's not enough to override everything else. Sixth, the dump site. Deidre's remains were found in a remote wooded area, not accessible by car. You'd have to hike in at least half a mile through rough terrain, or you could use an ATV, a four-wheeler, which could access the area via old logging road and trails. Christopher Revick had a four-wheeler with him that weekend. Investigators traced possible routes from downtown Wisconsin Rapids to the Blueberry Ridge area, about 5 miles. If you know the area, if you grew up there, hunted there, rode trails there, you'd know exactly where to go. Christopher Ravick grew up there. Now, let's be absolutely clear about something. This is circumstantial evidence, all of it. There's no DNA linking Ravick to Deidre Harm, no fingerprints, no blood evidence like in the Renee Williams case, no confession. What there is, opportunity, he was there, means he had the vehicle and knowledge. Matching witness descriptions, vehicle and general appearance, suspicious behavior, haircut and cleaning truck immediately after, and pattern, similarities to the murder we know he committed. In a courtroom, would this be enough to convict beyond reasonable doubt? Maybe, maybe not. That's for a jury to decide. But Wood County investigators, after reviewing everything, after consulting with the district attorney's office, after years of investigation, they believe Christopher Ravick killed Deidre Harm. By 2009, the plan is this. Prosecute Ravick in Missouri for Renee Williams, solid DNA case, blood evidence, Johanna's testimony. The case goes to trial first. Once he's convicted and prosecutors are confident about conviction, then pursue charges in Wisconsin for Deidre Harm. The Missouri conviction establishes pattern, establishes that Christopher Ravick is capable of this exact crime, makes the circumstantial evidence in Wisconsin more compelling. It's a sound strategy, but it never happens. Because in 2009, while waiting trial, Christopher Ravick takes his own life, dead. Before trial, before testimony, before any verdict, and with him, any chance of answers dies too. Christopher Ravick's death left law enforcement across multiple states with a profound problem. Two women, two likely murders, strong evidence in one case, compelling circumstantial evidence in another, and the suspect is dead. No trial, no justice in the traditional sense, no closure for families, but it also raised a darker question. Were there more? In the immediate aftermath of Ravick's arrest and death, the Douglas County Sheriff's Office in Missouri held a press conference. The sheriff said, "We believe Christopher Ravick may be connected to as many as 4 murders across multiple states. We're working with other jurisdictions to investigate potential links." 4 murders. We know about Deidre Harm. We know about Renee Williams. That's 2. Who are the other 2? The sheriff's office never publicly named specific cases. The investigation was real. Detectives from Wisconsin, Missouri, and potentially other states met, compared notes, looked at cold cases. Here's what they were looking for. Victimology. Young to middle-aged women, bar or social settings, late night, geography, Wisconsin or Missouri, particularly areas where Revick lived or visited. Timeline, mid-2000s, roughly 2004 through 2009. Method, strangulation or asphyxiation. Victims who disappeared and were either found in remote areas or never found at all. And they found possibilities. One case that's drawn attention, though never officially confirmed, as linked. A young woman in southern Missouri disappeared in 2008 from the rural bar. 28 years old, closed her shift, never made it home, never found. Christopher Revick was living and working as an EMT in the county at the time. Is it connected? Investigators looked. Couldn't find definitive evidence linking Revick, but couldn't rule him out either. Another case, a Jane Doe found in a wooded area in central Wisconsin in 2005. Never identified. Cause of death, homicide by strangulation. 2005, Revick was still living in Wisconsin. Again, no confirmed link, but the method matches. The location matches. The problem with trying to establish a wider pattern in the nature of the evidence? With Revick dead, you can't interview him. Can't pressure him for information. Can't offer deals for confessions. You can't search his current property because it's been years and other people live there now. You can't get warrants for his phone records, his computers, his vehicle. Not after death. Privacy laws still apply. What you're left with is cold cases. And you're trying to find connections to a man who can't be questioned. Some investigators I spoke with, off the record, believed the actual number could be higher than 4. They point to his job, EMT, night shifts, legitimate reason to be driving around rural areas at odd hours. Nobody questions an ambulance on a back road at 3 a.m. They point to his knowledge of the region. Grew up in Wisconsin, knew every back road, every logging trail, every remote area where something could be hidden. And they point to his pattern. If he killed Renee Williams in Missouri and likely killed Deidre Harm in Wisconsin, those are separated by 9 months and hundreds of miles. What about the gaps? The years in between? The travel back and forth? But speculation, even educated speculation, isn't evidence. And without evidence, cases remain unsolved. Families remain without answers. The Douglas County Sheriff's suggest up to 4 murders remains just that. A suggestion, a possibility. Not because investigators aren't looking, but because the one person who knows the truth is dead. And monsters don't usually confess from the grave. I told you at the beginning of this episode that some places remember. Let me tell you what I mean by that. Every location connected to Christopher Revick's crime has been marked by the same phenomenon. Blueberry Ridge, where Deidre Harm was found. Hunters and investigators reporting temperature drops. And audible experiences, overwhelming dread. The Eagles Lodge parking lot, where Renee disappeared. Forensic teams hearing her voice when they process the blood evidence. The terrible sadness in the air. Even Revick's truck, investigators processing it reported the same thing. Cold, dread, the sense of being watched, The forensic psychologist I consulted offered one explanation: traumatic imprinting. The theory of extreme violence can leave measurable psychological effects on environments. That human beings, when exposed to places where terrible things happen, may experience what feels like psychic residue. Our brains processing trauma through sensory hallucinations, temperature sensitivity, audio phenomenon. Not supernatural psychological, but here's what troubles me about that explanation. Multiple people, different locations, different times, all reporting remarkably similar experiences. And not just vague feeling of unease, specific details, voices, words. Please help. Johanna Revick describing the cold and sadness radiating from the truck before any investigators reported similar experiences, before she could have known. So what is it? Mass psychological phenomenon? Or collective brain trying to make sense of horror? Or something else? Something we don't fully understand. Today, if you drive to Blueberry Ridge, and people do, morbidly curious. Local residents say the area still feels wrong. Colder than it should be. Heavy. Hikers who don't know the history report feeling unwelcome, feeling watched, turning back without understanding why. The Eagles Lodge in Ava, still operating, still serving drinks, but employees don't like to work late shifts alone. They don't like to close by themselves, don't like standing in that parking lot after midnight. They won't say why, not officially, but off the record, they feel it. Whether you believe in psychic resonance, psychic, traumatic imprinting, or collective psychological response, the fact remains that something lingers in these places. Christopher Revick left more than bodies. He left marks on the world that haven't faded. Places that remember. November 18, 2024. 18 years after Deidre Harm disappeared, the Wood County Sheriff's Department and Wisconsin Rapids Police Department hold a joint press conference. The statement: after extensive investigation and consultation with the District Attorney's Office, we are officially closing the Deidre Harm homicide case. Christopher Revick has been identified as the responsible party. Closed. Christopher Revick named as responsible. For Wood County law enforcement, the investigation is over. No further active work planned. For Deidre's family, I hope it brings some measure of closure. Knowing a name, knowing that authorities believed they identified who took her from them. But it's not a conviction. It's not a trial. It's not a traditional justice. Sometimes, this is the best we get. The Renee Williams case technically remained open because her body was never recovered. Douglas County investigators haven't stopped looking. If someone comes forward with information about where Christopher Revick took her, they'll pursue it. Renee Williams deserves to be brought home. And for those other possible victims, the case that may be connected but has never been confirmed, the door remains open. If you're listening to this and you have information about Christopher Revick, about his movements, his behavior, his trips back to Wisconsin, anywhere he spent time in the mid-2000s, please contact law enforcement. Wood County Sheriff's Department for information about Deidre Harm case. Douglas County Sheriff's Office in Missouri for information about Renee Williams. Any detail, no matter how small it seems to you, could be the piece someone's family has been searching for. If you were at a bar in Wisconsin Rapids that summer of 2006, if you saw something, heard something, noticed something that didn't feel right, it's not too late. If you've lived near the Ravick family in Missouri, if you worked with Christopher, responded to calls with him, saw him acting strange, come forward. Memories fade, yes. But sometimes, one detail, one confirmation, can make all the difference. And if there are other families out there, still waiting, still wondering about a daughter, or a sister, or a mother who disappeared, you're not forgotten. Investigators are still listening. The trail of Christopher Ravick is not wrapped neatly with answers. It's a shadow, a silhouette traced through fragments of possibilities. Two women we know of, maybe more. Lives cut short, families shattered, communities changed forever, and one man dead by his own hand, his secrets locked away. But maybe not all his secrets, because the places remember. Whether it's traumatic imprinting, mass psychological phenomenon, or something we don't have words for, something remains in those woods, in that parking lot, in the space where Christopher Ravick took life. Maybe it's a warning, or maybe it's the victims themselves refusing to be forgotten. I started this episode by telling you some crimes leave marks on families who will never stop grieving, on communities that will never feel quite as safe, and on the places themselves. Christopher Ravick moved through the world as a husband, a father, an EMT, someone trusted, someone who helped people. And he was a monster. That's what this show is about. The recognition. The monster we talk about. The monsters we talk about don't wear masks. They don't announce themselves. They don't look like nightmares. They look like us. They live among us. Until they don't. Thank you for joining me on Among Monsters. I'm Maya Vale. Stay curious, stay vigilant, because the monsters we talk about, they're not fairy tales. They're not movies. They're among us. Among Monsters is written and hosted by Maya Vale.